Welcome to the Hot Literati. The Hot Literati is my collective of cool, hot, well-read people. My name is Haley, and thank you for being here. If I sound a little tired or a little tangential, I apologize. It's 2 in the morning. I just got back to New York, and I am very sleepy, but I've been chewing on this train of thought forever, and I just want to get it out, and I want to have this up on Sunday, because I told you guys I would be more consistent. But yeah, today we're going to be talking about the Manic Pixie Dream Girl, but in very specific characters, and then we're going to be talking about the flip side of the Manic Pixie Dream Girl, which is just something I was thinking about earlier this year. So my own introduction to the Manic Pixie Dream Girl, I think I was like 19, I was script reading for this production company and writing coverage, and so many scripts compared themselves to The Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, so I watched that for the first time, maybe with my ex, I don't remember, and that's like a quintessential like Manic Pixie Dream Girl character, right? Like, we see her character through his eyes so much, and she's like so romanticized, but at the same time we get like so little of her experience of things, and she like dips in and out of his life. Or I think another really key one is Scott Pilgrim versus the World. The main female character, or the love interest I should say, in that film is very much like a Manic Pixie Dream Girl. Both are like great films, like I really like them. But I think that archetype is so interesting because when we turn to literature, I think we get, like, I think there are so many Manic Pixie Dream Girls in literature in general, especially in literature that's represented as, like, canonical. Like, I think about Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, like, his love interest in that could pretty much be a Manic Pixie Dream Girl because we get, like, again, these, like, furtive, romanticized glances of her, and she's, like, in and out of his life. Or, oh my gosh, I'm sure if we looked at, like, any of Fitzgerald's novels, like, he was such a romantic, so he, I think, like, romanticizing someone inevitably comes with a little bit of, like, dehumanizing. I think Flaubert's, like, The Sentimental Education does this in a really interesting, almost, like, conscious way. But the novel I want to pay mind to first is Gentlemen Prefer Blondes by Anita Loos, because it's a novel by a woman, right? It's like this 1920s novel that's satirical, and it's Lorelei Lee, the main character's journal. And Lorelei Lee is meant to be satire. Like, Anita Loos has said this herself, because she had this friend, I think, who was blonde, and everywhere where they went, she said that men would just, like, fawn after this friend. So she wrote a satirical diary from the perspective of, like, a blonde who is essentially, like, a gold digger, and I think it was one of the first, like, popular American novels to, like, kind of codify, A, like, the dumb blonde archetype, B, like, the gold digger archetype, and, you know, now we have, like, the legacy of the film and Marilyn Monroe are, like, remembered together, so they're, like, the legacies are so intertwined, and, I think that Marilyn's legacy is also really interesting. I watched Blonde recently, which I have a lot of thoughts. But I think when we look at the Lorelei Lee of the novel, we get this picture of, like, the inside of the, quote, like, Manic Pixie Dream Girl character. Like, this woman who's, like, so untouchable that she's almost, like, not real. And we get this, like, imagined version of what's going on in her head. And she's portrayed as, like, extremely ditzy, extremely innocent, like, very pure in a way. And when I say ditzy, I mean to the point of where there are so many typos in the book because Luce is insinuating that she, like, can't spell, which gets a little frustrating to read, but, you know, she really committed to the bit. Like, I guess you have to respect it a little. So that's, like, the imagined interiority of this, like, Manic Pixie Dream Girl character, right? And then I want to talk about Breakfast at Tiffany's, which I just finished on the plane today, and I think Breakfast at Tiffany's is interesting because we again have this, like, Manic Pixie Dream Girl character, like, this time it's from the perspective of a man, much like a lot of the films where this archetype is really, like, commonly identified in, because he, you know, he, like, he's obsessed with Holly Golightly, and he has these, like, glances of her when he first moves in, whether she's, like, buzzing the main character's door to, like, get up to her apartment, or throwing these, like, crazy parties, or running around with these men that he's observing, And he's also a writer, which is A, a red flag, and B, like, we know that this character is supposedly, like, really paying attention to her mannerisms and her nuance. And I think a very, like, writerly trait is wanting to get to the inside of someone, like, really wanting to understand what makes them tick. So I like, have mad respect for Capote for, I feel like, portraying that really well in Breakfast at Tiffany's. And Holly Golightly is this really, like, glamorous character, right? Like, she's reinvented herself. Nobody really knows, like, who she is. And I think this segues to one thing I really want to hark on, which is that the problem of the manic pixie dream girl, whether, like, fictitious, whether, like, performed in the real world or online, is that it almost perpetuates this idea of, like, as, like, a woman, or better yet, like, performed femininity, like, performed fun femininity, as something to experience, as something to be around, to, like, have a good time, to romanticize. Like, people aren't around Holly Golightly because they care about her in the book. They're around Holly Golightly because she throws these crazy parties and she's really cool and she's, like, glamorous and pretty. And, you know, similarly for Lorelai Lee, like, she is. It's like, I guess she just has a very different type of agency where she is a little more intentional about, no, they're both very intentional about positioning themselves around wealthy men, now that I say that. But she does it with this hint of, like, ditziness under it, so that because she doesn't, like, necessarily quote unquote want it or, like, know what she's doing, people are more willing to just, like, give to her. And this brings me to a quote in the sequel to Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, which is called But Gentlemen Marry Brunettes. I'm a little over halfway through it, and it's supposed to be the story of Dorothy as written by Lorelai, and Dorothy's the brunette best friend. But here's the quote. Dorothy said that, as far as she could gather, it meant everything was okay so long as you don't admit you enjoy it. So that's the thing that's so interesting about, like, this whole idea of experiencing femininity, or experiencing, like the fun performance of femininity through someone, is that, like, they're not supposed to be enjoying it. They're supposed to be just, like, giving and giving and giving, and maybe enjoying, like, the enjoyment of the other person. But culturally, when we look at, like, literature, which Gentlemen Prefer Blondes was, like, 1920s. And it looks like Breakfast at Tiffany's was 1958, I think. So, you know, these are definitely, like, older. But at the same time, just in my own dating life and in my own experiences, granted, I have some that are a little more, like, unique, but I feel like this is something I've definitely experienced. And this brings me to, like, my grand thesis of the manic pixie dream girl. I think that the manic pixie dream girl is portrayed as, like, unreliable or, like, furtive or almost, like, ephemeral. But I think if we get to the flip side of someone who in, like, pop culture is portrayed as this, or, like, if we were to be able to, like, follow them throughout a narrative of a story, we would see that they're, like, furtive because they're being dehumanized by another character, another perspective, and they're only being seen in, like, brief glances. But they're also, like, not allowed to have flaws through that person's gaze. So if we followed them, like, truly followed them, or, like, went into their interiority, we would see that they have, like, a lot of flaws because they are supposedly, like, a real person. That's the thing about, like, Lorelai Lee, is it can only ever be satire. It can only ever be fun, because it's not a real person. And I think that we see the truth in this when we really lean into, like, the legacy of Marilyn Monroe and, like, culture's obsession with her, right? Because in her films, she's always this character that's, like satirical performed femininity, that's very, like, sweet, very babyish, very innocent, and kind of like that quote in But Gentlemen Marry Brunettes, like, never has, like, bad intentions, never wants anything, and never, like, truly enjoys it, right? It's always, like, the enjoyment of someone else enjoying her. And I think for the longest time, like, it seems to me, at least, like, that's how her legacy of Marilyn Monroe was, like, in culture. And then when she passed away, it was, like, a tragedy, true. But now people are obsessed with, like, trying to tap into that interiority and trying to understand, like, what her perspective and her side of things were like. And we see this with blonde for sure. But to me, I think blonde at the same time, like, also strips her of her agency because it is like a fictitious depiction of her life that people are not taking as fiction or understanding as fiction, which, even posthumously, I think has to be frustrating, maybe. And it also painted her as someone without agency, someone who was just like genuinely like sad all the time, which that could have been her like lived reality. But to me, it seemed like this like a new type of romanticization through the lens of like sadness, because I feel like we're at this time in culture where sadness and struggle are seen as like really profound and really beautiful. And that's why with my own writing, like, I always try to lean into the word of like poignancy, because I think poignancy and sadness are very different. And maybe this like inclination towards sadness and tragedy in media now is like, maybe it's a reflection of like the mental health crisis that we're in or things like that. But I think in Blonde, like, she's still a manic pixie dream girl, but she is in a very new way, right? Because it's not her being like cute and like babyish the entire time. It's just her being like sad and like lost and aimless the entire time, which, like, she had to have had some bright moments, and I refuse to believe that they're only like her with that throuple, that they're only her like when she was married to Arthur Miller when she was happier. Like, she had to have some independently for like her and her alone, you know? But at the same time, one thing that I do want to call attention to in Blonde, because I think it's a good segue back to Breakfast at Tiffany's, is the representation of her like romantic experiences. Because if we think about the feminine as like, or the manic pixie dream girl as something that people are like around to experience, I think an important hinge to recognize is that people want to be there when it's fun. But when the manic pixie dream girl breaks, when she's like sad, when she's having a moment, when she's doing something that's like not fun to be around, people leave. They leave, or they gossip, or they like shame her or guilt her. And I think we see this in Blonde a bit. And this might be a hot take, but I think the idol of the show actually did a really good job of representing this in a way, right? How this like larger than life person, this person who's like an experience, who's a show, who's like a house name, she's like cool. People want to be around her because she's cool, but then when she breaks down, she really breaks down. And I've talked a lot about this one American Sociological Association paper I had to read my freshman year during this course about celebrity culture that explores like the meaning of celebrity. And I think that that's a good document to understand like how bizarre celebrity culture is and how like psychologically bizarre it must feel to be like that famous. But I think we could also really like boil that down on a small scale, because what is fame if not like turning someone into an experience, turning someone into like an attraction, and doing that on any scale, I think, I wonder, has to be dehumanizing, right? Like, so we see that in the idol. We see her like break, and how even her breaking becomes like this thing that people, A, like don't want to be around, but also want to observe and like talk about from afar. And this takes me all the way back to Breakfast at Tiffany's. I think Breakfast at Tiffany's is a really effective like storytelling of this, and I think Capote gets like behind the curtain really well with the manic pixie dream girl figure, because the book's like a bit different from the movie. I've seen the movie like a million times, but in the book, she like gets arrested for like giving the weather report to the mafia man and all that, and when she basically she's like living with this guy who's not the protagonist, who she thinks she's going to marry, and she's like pregnant with his child. And then once she gets arrested, she gets like taken to prison, and then she finds out that she loses the baby. But when she's arrested, all of these people who were like, at her apartment for parties and were like wanting to be affiliated with her kind of like step back and start to like give bad blurbs about her in the press. And this man who she's like, they both, her and the man, think that she's pregnant with his child. And He essentially sends her this letter that says, like, I'm sorry, like, I can't be affiliated with you now. I just don't have, like, the bravery. And the male protagonist, who the book is from his perspective, he, like, goes to the hospital to visit her and brings this letter. And one thing I thought was so interesting is that he's going to read it for her, but she puts on her makeup before he does. And she says, a girl doesn't read this sort of thing without her lipstick. And I'm just gonna read this quote because I think it's really fascinating. Guided by a compact mirror, she powdered, painted every vestige of her 12-year-old out of her face. She shaped her lips with one tube, colored her cheeks from another. She penciled the rims of her eyes, glued the lids, sprinkled her neck with 4711, attached pearls to her ears, and donned her dark glasses, thus armored. And after a displeased appraisal of her manicure's shabby condition, she ripped open the letter and let her eyes race through it, while her stony small smile grew smaller and harder. So I think, like, the words that really stick out to me in this are, like, armored, right? Or her getting rid of, like, 12-year-old out of her face. Because I think Capote does a great job of showing how, like, the Manic Pixie Dream Girl as a performance is essentially like armor, right? Because I think it's like dehumanizing in the sense of like people won't let you be a real person. Like they expect you to be an experience and they expect you to be fun to be around. And then when you're not, it's like, oh, I don't know what's going on. I'm gonna get away from her. But at the same time, like, I think I've definitely had phases of my life where I lean into performance. I think when I was heavily involved in pageants, that's something that I did. And I have friends who I've had conversations with this like who work in like entertainment, and they agree they've had like parts of their life or like phases still where they lean into like a more performative version of themselves. And while the way in which people engage with you when you're doing that is like dehumanizing, at the same time, like leaning into that sort of a performance, I think, becomes an armor like in and of itself. And it becomes like a defense mechanism, right? Because if you can make yourself like fun to be around, if you can be like performative and like whimsical, then people kind of treat you with this reverence. But at the same time, I think it's also a defense mechanism because if you're performing like a special version of yourself and that version is rejected, then that's not you, you know? Like when I was leaning into being like Miss Teen USA and I was like running around my campus and like going to events and things, like, and someone didn't like that version of myself. Like, it didn't hurt as much if I had truly just been like me. Like, I'm a very like chill, like low energy person. And I have like the things that I'm passionate about, which are like literature, obviously, and like art. And if I like bare that part of myself to someone and they rejected that, like, that actually hurts a lot more than like leaning into this performed like pageant girl and that version of myself having been rejected. So it becomes this armor. But I think one thing that really haunts me, just given like my own experiences, is that the armor has to come off eventually. Like the makeup comes off, like the performed self has to fall away eventually. And what do you do when you're just left with that? Like, you know, hopefully there's like one person or like a family or group of people someday who are comfortable with like that, like the normal self and then like the ugly sides as well. But I think it's just food for thought. It's like something interesting to think about. And I want to wrap up with a quote from Breakfast at Tiffany's. It's towards the end, because I mean, the book ends a lot differently than the movie. But she's like fleeing the country essentially after this whole like mafia scandal. And she's in a car service with the protagonist and she like kicks the cat out. But then she regrets kicking the cat out and she can't find it. And the male protagonist says that he's going to find it for her and he like promises that he'll take care of the cat. And she says one thing to him after this. She whispers it. And that thing is, but what about me? And I think this gets to like the core of this question of like the Manic Pixie Dream Girl, whether it's this like ditzy blonde that like people like to be around and like millionaires like to be around, or if it's like Holly Golightly throwing parties in her apartment, or if it's like Lily Rose Depp's character, like putting on a great show, but then also having this like breakdown on stage, or even if it's me when I was Miss Teen USA, because I had a lot of like really great moments, but I had a lot of like really ugly moments that year too. And maybe I'm projecting, maybe it's subjective, like person to person, but I feel like at the core of this person, like having been rewarded for this like performed self and looked on with like awe and reverence for this performed self, I feel like at the core of this is wanting someone to like look at you, to see you for who you are without any of the show, and like that version, and like not too much, like not reverence, not awe, but just like comfort and care and compassion. But I guess a person who will look at you like that will have never seen you as a manic pixie dream girl in the first place. So justice for the manic pixie dream girl.